This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Exodus. Now, here's Pastor Sandy with today's study through the book of Exodus, chapters 1 through 3.
Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. She sees the basket. She commands her servants to go and fetch the child. Here is an amazing work of God's providence. God overseeing circumstances, working them out according to his purposes. Now, we don't really know the identity of Pharaoh's daughter at the time, but there is a good possibility that she was a girl named Hatshepsut. She was the barren daughter of Amenhotep I, a powerful, politically powerful princess, incidentally. Hatshepsut later became queen, and it could be that she looked on the baby Moses as an heir to the throne, as her heir to succeed her in ruling over Egypt. Cecil B. DeMille's classic movie, The Ten Commandments, you've seen it, I'm sure. Really and truly, it's not that far off historically. DeMille developed the storyline of his movie by weaving together the biblical accounts along with some extra biblical sources, namely Josephus. And so it's really quite accurate. You know, there's an interesting Jewish legend. It comes from the Talmud that tells an interesting story about the baby Moses. I think it's worth repeating. One day, the story goes, while playing on Pharaoh's lap, the child, Moses, grabbed the king's crown. And he tossed it on the floor. And then he got down off the Pharaoh's lap and stomped on the crown. Obviously, his actions were prophetic. I mean, the baby's antics were a preview of coming attractions. And the Egyptian magicians, they took this incident seriously. They saw it as an act of treason. And from that day forward, they viewed Moses with a suspicion. The king, though, he sort of laughed the whole thing off as child's play. Well, Pharaoh told the magicians, after they expressed their concern, that if this baby really, you know, if their suspicions were true, if this baby was given a choice, it would prove that it was really just an infantile, you know, it didn't really have much of an intellect, didn't have much of a cognitive reasonings and all going. And so they suggested that he be given a choice between a hot coal and a piece of gold. And the Pharaoh said, hey, this is just a baby. If given a choice between a hot coal and a piece of gold, obviously the baby will choose the hot coal. You know, there's no way. The baby doesn't even know what's valuable and what's not. Well, when they put Moses to this little test, sure enough, the baby grabbed the hot coal and actually stuck it in its mouth as babies do. And the legend goes that the hot coal burned Moses' tongue and caused a permanent speech impediment. And later, when Moses is called by God to go to Egypt, you know, he will use as an excuse, I'm slow of speech, I can't speak, Lord. He'll use this speech impediment as an excuse. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a bit, aren't we? Back at the riverside, verse 6. And when she had opened the ark or the basket, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. And so the woman, and guess who that woman was? It was Jochebed. It was his mother, took the child and nursed him. Here's another act of God's providence. Pharaoh's daughter appoints Moses' own natural mother to nurse him. In ancient times, kids were nursed and breastfed, not for a few months, but for several years. And thus this gave Jochebed time to teach her son some of God's truth. Well, verse 10 tells us, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And so she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. The Hebrew word Moshe means to draw out. And so Moses became his name. It's interesting, in Acts chapter 7, verses 21 and 22, Stephen gives us some details into the life of Moses that we really don't get anywhere else. He sort of fills in a gap in Moses' early history. There, Stephen says, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. As the queen's son, Moses was educated in Egypt's finest academies. I mean, he got the kind of education we give kids here at Calvary Chapel Christian School. It was amazing. You know, it's an irony, though. What a sense of humor God shows. Moses was the baby that the Pharaoh was trying to kill. Instead, God works it out where the Pharaoh bankrolls his room, board, and education. God always gets the last laugh. Imagine what this must have been like, though, for Moses. Imagine a child from one of the poorest of the poor families in Haiti. Suddenly, he gets whisked away on a jet airplane. He lands in the White House, and he's adopted by the president and Mrs. Bush. Moses and Bushes seem to go together. We'll find out later. But this is literally what happens to Moses. I mean, he goes from poverty to privilege. He goes from slavery to the royal family. What an incredible turn of events for Moses. It's interesting, one other note. Stephen says, Moses was mighty in words and deeds. Moses must have been very successful in his education. The Egyptians would have schooled him in science and in engineering. They were quite the engineers. The pyramids are a great example. And in literature and astronomy and in chemistry and in law and in philosophy and on it goes. One of the mighty deeds that he performed that's mentioned by Josephus, the Jewish historian says that when Moses was around 30 years old, this young Egyptian prince led the Egyptian army against the Ethiopians and won a great victory. As a matter of fact, DeMille actually makes reference to that episode in his movie. Apparently, 40 years now elapse between verses 10 and 11. 40 years. Acts chapter 7 again, verse 23, Stephen tells us, now when Moses was 40 years old, that's how we know 40 years elapsed. When Moses was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. Apparently, Moses knew all along his racial identity. And evidently, it produced some kind of personal crisis within his heart. For as the prince in the royal court, Moses knew he was in line to succeed the Pharaoh. He could one day be king over all Egypt. But Moses also knew that Egypt was not his home. And God put a stirring, God put a restlessness in Moses' heart. Moses became disenchanted with the world, with the frills and thrills of Egypt. He longed for more. He wanted to know God, and he wanted to discover God's purposes for his life. I hope you have that longing tonight. I hope you're really not believing tonight that this world can satisfy your deepest longings. I hope you don't think for one second that this world can give you what you're really looking for. You were made with a desire for God. Each one of us was made with a longing for God. And until we find God, we will be restless. We'll be unhappy. It's only when we find God that we come back home and find that for which we were created for in the first place. Well, Hebrews 11 verse 24 sums up Moses' spiritual awakening. It says, by faith Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And all of Egypt had not given him any kind of lasting satisfaction. They were all just passing pleasures. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward, and by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Verse 11 records the exact incident. Now it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. He wanted to get an up-close look at how his people, the Hebrews, were actually being treated. But he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren, and he couldn't believe the cruelty, the injustice that this taskmaster was taking upon this Hebrew. And so he reacted. He just reacted. He looked this way and that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. Now this is not an act of obedience to God. If Moses were taking a stand for God, he wouldn't have looked this way and that way to see if no one was looking. No, if he were taking a stand for God, he would have looked upward. He would have put his faith in God and trusted in God, no matter what anyone might have thought. But Moses, you see, he looks this way, he looks that way to see if no one's looking. In other words, he's on his own. He is relying on his own cunning and in his own cleverness to deliver these Hebrews. In other words, he's trying to serve God, but he's doing it in his own strength. Happens to us a lot, doesn't it? We want to serve God, but we step out in our own strength, on our own, in our own confidence. Moses kills this Egyptian with his bare hands and hides the corpse in the sand. Well, verse 13 says, "And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting, and he said to the one who did the wrong, 'Why are you striking your companion?' And then he said, 'Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?'" The word is out. It's on the streets. The news has hit the streets. So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh. Rather than risk arrest, Moses chooses to flee, to be a fugitive. And he flees from the land of Egypt, and he hides out in the desert. We're told, "And he dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well." Now imagine how disillusioned Moses must have been. I mean, he could have helped these Hebrews. He had some clout. He had some political power. Man, he had connections, and he could have alleviated their suffering. But they ratted him out. They shot themselves in the foot. And thanks to the people, Moses wasn't able to help anybody. He has now lost everything. Imagine how depressed Moses must have been. In Acts 7, verse 25, Stephen again tells us of Moses' disappointment. He says, "For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand." He supposed. He made a mistake in supposing. Apparently, Moses had gained a sense of his Hebrew identity, and he wondered why the Hebrews didn't recognize him as their deliverer. Again, Moses wanted to serve God. He wanted to deliver his people, but now he is stripped of all of his earthly influence. Everything he was relying on, everything he was trusting in, is now gone. And guys, in God's plan, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. For God always does his will his way. He works through our faith, not through our flesh. He works in his ways, not through necessarily through our strength and our ingenuity. And Moses here is the classic example. Here's a man trying to serve God, but doing it through his own genius, through his own power. Moses is relying on worldly position and worldly clout, not on the power of God. And that's a mistake. And Moses has a lot to learn. He has spent 40 years in the schools of Egypt. Now God enrolls him for the next 40 years in the school of brokenness, in the school of the wilderness. Remember chapter 46 of Genesis, chapter 46, verse 34, where we were told that the Egyptians despised shepherds? You remember that little detail that we uncovered? They looked down their nose at shepherds as lowlifes. Egyptians hated shepherds. Well, guess what? God now makes Moses a shepherd. A shepherd. Moses has to be broken of his pride, of his self-sufficiency. He has to be broken of his own confidence in himself so that he can be used by God. He has to learn to trust in God, not in his own strength. And God is about to change Moses from a man who looks this way and who looks that way to a man who looks upward, who walks by faith, not by sight, who has confidence in God, not in himself. Well, verse 16 tells us what happens to Moses in Midian. Now, the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. Girls first was not a Midianite motto. The men went first, then the women. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. He became their knight in shining armor. He drove the men away so that they could water their flocks first. And when they came to Reuel, their father, this man also goes by the name of Jethro, by the way, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." And perhaps they called Moses an Egyptian because he still was wearing Egyptian clothes, maybe, or still had an Egyptian haircut, perhaps. He looked like an Egyptian in some way, apparently. And so Reuel said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." Then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. Moses finds a wife. Where does he find a wife? By a well. Isn't it amazing how many people in the Bible find their wife by a well? If you're single tonight, you ought to go off and find a well somewhere and just sit down and kind of wait a while. Who knows? And she bore him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." And of course, the Greek word Gershom means stranger. One of the truths that we'll discover as we go through the Old Testament is that if you look close enough, you will find Jesus on every single page. There's a picture of him everywhere. And here again, we see Jesus in a typological sense. Recall the first time Moses goes to the Hebrews to deliver them. What did they do? They reject him. They only receive him when he comes to them the second time. Isn't that interesting? You know, Jesus came the first time to his people, the Hebrews. And what did they do? They rejected him. But we know that when he comes again, they'll look on him whom they have pierced. And they will repent over how they've treated him. And they'll embrace him as their Messiah. Not the first time he comes to them, but the second time he comes again to them. And it's interesting. What does Moses do between these two comings? He takes a Gentile bride. And guess what Jesus is doing between this first coming and his second coming? He too is taking a Gentile bride, his church, you and I. And in a sense, we're Gershoms, aren't we? We're strangers and pilgrims on this earth. This world is not our home. Amazing the pictures we see here of Jesus. Verse 23. Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. I want you to understand, wherever there are suffering people, God hears their cries, and he feels compassion toward them. But I also want you to notice that empathy alone is not what moves God here to action. Not just compassion moves God to action. What prompts God to work on behalf of a people is a covenant. You see, God loves everybody. God wants to help everybody, but God doesn't move on behalf of people until they are in a covenant relationship with him. There are a lot of people tonight God would love to help, but they've forsaken a relationship with Him. They don't want to be in covenant with Him, and therefore God can't help them. Hear these people cry out, but it's because of the covenant that He's made with them that He goes to work on their behalf. We're told in verse 24, so God heard their groaning, and notice this, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. In Genesis 15, verse 13, 600 years earlier, God had promised Abraham, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years, but in the fourth generation they shall return here. And now those 400 years are about over, and God has heard the cries of His covenant people, and He has recalled the promise to them that He's made, and He is now preparing for them a deliverer. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. Again, God acknowledged them, not just because He had empathy or compassion toward them, but because they had a covenant with Him. And the covenant that God acknowledges today, guys, is the one that He's made through Jesus Christ. Trust in Jesus, and you can have a relationship with God, and you will get in line with God's help and God's assistance and God's power. If you have a covenant with God, He'll come and work on your behalf. Well, chapter 3 begins. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, or Reuel, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Horeb is actually a mountain range. Sinai is the actual peak. The traditional Mount Sinai is a site called Jebel Musa, which is called the Mountain of Moses, and it sits in the south-central portion of the Sinai Peninsula. Jebel Musa is a mountain that looks like the Rock of Gibraltar, just sort of coming up out of the ground. It's 7,500 feet above sea level. There are other theories, though, as to the identity of the mountain of God. Charles turned me on to a few interesting websites. If you want to do some research into this, you can check with him. But some folks place the mountain of God in the northwestern corner of Saudi Arabia, east of the Gulf of Aqaba. There's a mountain there called Jebel el-Laws that also fits this description. And so I suppose the exact identity of Mount Sinai is sort of up for debate. Now imagine that you and your family are out on a picnic. You're in this green grassy meadow. That may be a stretch, but let's just pretend you're in this green grassy meadow, sort of before you're before Stone Mountain, you know. Right, you've gone down, you're going to take in the laser show a little later. And you're down there, you've spread out your blanket, and you've just popped the top on a Kentucky Fried Chicken box, and you're just looking around at the trees, and suddenly you see a strange sight. There's an azalea bush on fire. But it's not oxidizing. The bush is burning, but it's not consumed. Well, this is what Moses sees. Verse 2. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. And so he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. I imagine he would have said that. I'm going to take a closer look. It's not every day you see a burning bush. Verse 4. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. And then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground.
Listening to Bible teaching here on the radio is a huge blessing that many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world simply don't have. We rejoice in this opportunity to share Pastor Sandy's messages with you. We do want to be sure to remind you that radio is not a church. Radio should be a complement to what God is already doing in your personal discipleship through the local body of believers that you're a part of. Maybe you're listening today. You don't have a home church. You've visited various places, but nothing seems to fit. First, if you live in the Atlanta, Georgia area, we want to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. We meet every Sunday morning at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. For more information, including driving directions, please log on to sandyadams.org and follow the link to the church website. Now, if you're listening outside of the Atlanta, Georgia area and are looking for a home church, we encourage you to log on to calvarychapel.com and find a Calvary Chapel in your area that teaches through the Bible just like Pastor Sandy does each day here on this program. Well, we wish we had more time today, but we've come to the close of today's broadcast. Be sure to remember to join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through God's Word. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.